Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. I'm Mark Zitter, chair of the ZEDEMA Project, a member of the club's Board of Governors, and your moderator for this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, a former New York Times correspondent, and author of the new book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. After 22 years as a correspondent for the New York Times, where she covered a variety of beats ranging from healthcare to the environment, and also worked in the Beijing Bureau, Dr. Rosenthal joined Kaiser Health News last September as editor-in-chief. She's a graduate of Stanford University, so she's kind of a local, and also Harvard Medical School. She briefly practiced emergency room medicine in New York City before converting to journalism. Today, she is here to reveal what she says are the dark details about the relationships between hospitals, doctors, insurance companies, and drug manufacturers, where financial issues often dominate concerns for patients. She says her goal is to start a loud conversation that will be politically difficult to ignore. Please welcome Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal.
Thank you. Well, thanks, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back in the Bay Area. As Mark said, it's been a long time since I left Stanford, and I've always looked for reasons to come back around here. I thought I would give you a little bit of a backdrop to why I wrote this book, which will explain about the form it took. This, for me, was my third child, really. It was a labor of love and passion and a book that I'd been a journalist for decades, but this was the first time I thought, I really have to do this. I have to say something about this topic. As you heard, I trained as a physician. My dad was a physician, so the profession is really important to me. I'd always been a writer on the side, and ironically, I left the practice of medicine in the 1990s to write for the New York Times about something you may remember, the Clinton health reform. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did at the time was I was working in an urban emergency room, and for people like me who were well insured, the system was working pretty well then. But for the people I saw in the emergency room who often didn't have insurance or weren't very plugged into the system, it was working badly already. So I thought, well, I'm going to go to the New York Times, I'll write about this Clinton health reform, and it will pass, and then I'll go back to being a doctor, and it didn't, and I didn't, so here I am. And you know, after that, I was kind of hooked on journalism. I spent a decade out of the U.S. largely as a foreign correspondent, first in Beijing and then covering international environment, which I was quite passionate about. And in the end, that really influenced what this book was. Overseas, I'd experienced a number of different health systems in my travels, and now I'm going to sound really accident-prone, but so I broke my wrist in Sweden and, you know, called the New York Times HR people, and they found, like, a super-duper orthopedist there who saw me in his office, took an X-ray, casted my wrist, and apologized profusely for having to charge me $400 for this whole procedure. I fell jogging again in Rome, and went to the got a big cut in my forehead and went to Gemelli Hospital, which is, as many of you may know, the Pope's Hospital in Rome, so not too shabby. They stitch up my forehead and again apologize for charging me, and it was just over $100. So that was kind of what felt normative to me while I was overseas. And I knew in that decade, I was away between 97 and 2007, and I knew in that decade, I'd heard a lot from my friends that healthcare in the U.S. had gotten really, really expensive and insurance had gotten not so great, not covering as much of the costs. So when I got back in 2007, I was a little surprised by things I was seeing, which were a little alarming. Like when I had trained, there was a new antibiotic called Augmentin, which was for penicillin-resistant infections. It was really, really great, and it cost like $30. And then when I got back, one of my kids had an ear infection. I went into pharmacy, and suddenly this antibiotic, which was now off patent, was costing over $100 for a course. And I thought, wow, that's weird. Likewise, I have mild asthma, so I had an inhaler, which before I left was costing me $10. And suddenly I got back in this inhaler, which looked basically the same, but now it had a little counter on the back. You know, that was the new improved version. And it cost, again, close to $100. I'm thinking, wow, this system, something's really going on here. But my real kind of aha moment came. I was 50 when I came back, and I had to do that ritual of entering middle age of, you know, the colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. So here I go. This is, and I was, you know, I had my antenna up for cost at this point. So I asked the HR department, well, how can I get a screening colonoscopy in network? And they said, well, here are a list of places that are in our insurance network, and we'll do it for you, and you'll get it with no out-of-pocket costs. So on that list was a certain cancer center in New York City, which I'll go unnamed. And I signed up there, and I thought, and I had trained partly at this center, so I knew my way around there. So I go in the day of my colonoscopy. I'm getting a hospital wristband. I'm getting booties, a bonnet. They're taking my clothes. And I'm on a gurney, and I'm being wheeled into what is essentially a full-blown operating room at Sloan Kettering Hospital with, you know, anesthesiologists and monitors and, you know, all these guys, nurses and scrubs. And I'm a little bit concerned about, wow, how much is this going to cost? And then I get my shot of propofol, and everything is great, you know, and I wake up with a clean bill of colon health. But I was pretty surprised about a month later when I got my explanation of benefits, which I read and which I think everyone should look at, and saw that this hospital had charged $11,000 for my screening colonoscopy. And my insurer had this kind of chirpy note attached saying, you know, good news, we've negotiated, on your behalf, we've negotiated the price for you, and we're just paying $9,000, and your out-of-pocket responsibility is zero. So I suppose, you know, I should have been happy. You know, zero is a good number for me to pay. But I was really pissed because I know, and I think we should all remember, that a country that pays $9,000 for screening colonoscopies that are done for $300, $400 bucks in many European countries is a country that has that spends 20% of its GDP on healthcare, that has rising premiums, rising copays, rising deductibles. It's not sustainable. So anyway, that kind of set me on a path at the New York Times, where I, when the ACA was in play at that point or being debated, my managing editor said, we'd like you to come back to healthcare reporting. And I said, the only thing I want to do in healthcare right now is to write about healthcare costs, because I want to know why it's so expensive. I want to understand how this system got to be this way. You know, we all know the numbers, and we're all kind of numb to the numbers, 20% of the GDP, 2 to 3 times as much as we spend, two to three times as much per person as other developed countries. And, you know, Americans have heard these stats so many times now, and we kind of feel like it's a law of physics, that it's just inevitable that this is going to have to be this way. But, it, you know, it's really, I think, reaching a tipping point for many families who are spending 20 to 30% of their disposable income on insurance and minor health issues. This is not when, you know, you need a liver transplant or something. It's maybe someone needed a hernia operation or arthroscopy. I now work for Kaiser Health News, which I have to say always is not affiliated in any way with Kaiser Permanente. We're a nonprofit, separate nonprofit news service focusing on health policy and investigative health journalism that's under the Kaiser Family Foundation. The foundation did a survey last year that found that about a quarter of people under 65 with good insurance nonetheless had trouble paying for their medical bills. That's a pretty damning statistic. So I always like to ask audiences, you know, how many people here have open bills that surprise them or made no sense or that cause financial stress? Anyone? Yeah. I mean, it's the American experience, unfortunately, now. And people from other countries always ask me, you know, why do you guys put up with this? You know, why this doesn't make any, this is terrible. Why do you stand up? Why do Americans put up with this? And I think you hear it a lot now from my time overseas. You know, friends from Europe are reluctant to come to the U.S. because they're worried about, what if I get in an accident? What are the costs going to be? How will I bear that? I heard for the book from one young German guy who was here in San Francisco, was in a minor bike accident, got taken to San Francisco General, which is, you know, a great hospital. And he didn't have serious injuries, but the triage nurse had called in the trauma team in case, and so on his bill was something like a $9,000 trauma activation fee. And, you know, he was like, well, what does this mean? And I'm sure no one in that ER knew that that call was generating that fee, and that's part of the problem that we see. Likewise, I have another patient who's in the book, Tiffany Spive. She was an American living in Istanbul who chose to have her second child there rather than coming home to the U.S. And she said, I have 20,000 reasons, dollars, right? And that's sad. Likewise, a PhD student at Washington University in St. Louis, who is looking for postdocs only in overseas because she has type 1 diabetes. And the cost of type 1 diabetes, even with good insurance in the U.S., is extraordinarily high. Insulin has increased in price by about 400% in the last 4 or 5 years. There are patent wars going on over long-acting insulin, which has made the price here much more expensive than in other countries. And, you know, she can't live without it. Type 1 diabetics need that insulin or they die. So anyway, the point of this book, in many ways, is to understand how this unfolded, how we got to this place, because I think the first step, the overarching point is to say we don't have to put up with this. There are things we can do, and there are places to start doing them right now. The first part was about, and it was very personal for me, to help understand how we got to this system that no one would design. You know, no one likes it anymore. And so the first part of the book, what I tried to understand was to unspool the history of how we got to this profit-oriented system and how we got to a place in a quarter century where, when I trained, there were values that were the first value of medicine. Of course, you have to do things efficiently, and you can't, you know, do things that are going to make you go broke. But the first value was, is it good for patients? It was a caring endeavor. It was a profession. And I think in the period of 25 years during my life, it's moved to a commercial endeavor that's largely driven by the finances. And that's really tragic, you know. And I think one symptom of this is when we talk about healthcare reform and innovation, we talk about, you know, we're doing this innovation so we can get to patient-centered, evidence-based care. And I'd repeated that phrase hundreds of times. And then I thought as I started this book, well, wait a second, like, what other kind of healthcare can there be? You know, what is it if it's not patient-centered and evidence-based care? And I think what we have in this country now is healthcare, and not that anyone is sitting there saying, you know, I'm going to do this operation because I have to pay my kids' college tuition or I want a new car, but healthcare where finances come first and drive often the choices we make. So we can talk more about that when we start discussing this, and how we got to this place. You know, so my message in the second part of the book is the situation is not hopeless, although it may feel that way when you throw up your hands and write a check for what you owe now with the, 20% prompt payment discount for a service that's, you know, 3010.2 that you have no idea what that is. So that's where the second part of the book comes in, that I think we have to feel more entitled to take on the system, both individually and collectively. And while that may not change this very frustrating system right away, it can save you money and affect changes. So just as a little example, I'm just going to give you a few little examples because I use them now with my own physician. When I go to a physician and he says, you need a blood test, I immediately say, okay, fine, tell me what it's for. Because often, I mean, those of us who are physicians in the room know that when you're ordering blood tests, you get a sheet and it's like, check, 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 check. Or in some cases, at some hospitals now, it's kind of on auto order. So you want to ask, you know, what is this for? And even more than that now, my second and bigger request is, please send this blood to an in-network lab. And don't you send it to the hospital lab. My physician's computer is programmed to send it to his hospital lab, but it's far more expensive than if he sends it to Quest or LabCorp. So I've saved a lot of money that way, and I think we should all ask to start making the whole system more responsive and more sensitive to our needs. Likewise, in the book, I've become an expert at the New York Times. I was kind of the troubleshooter for everyone's hospital bills. So I perfected the language of letters to the hospital when you want to say, you know, informed consent is the bedrock of medical care. But you never get informed financial consent, and you don't get informed consent if there's a doctor who's not in your network. So I have perfected the informed consent letters saying, you know, I see that there's this a bill from Dr. X who is not in my network. I never consented to this treatment. I never consented to out-of-network physician. So therefore, I'm not going to pay this bill. In New York State, you now have legal backing for doing that. In many states, you don't. But I've found these letters are quite effective. I mean, you're in the right, and I think that's part of the problem, that we're kind of cowed by a system that feels overwhelming, and often the law is on your side in these issues, but the hospital is not going to tell you. I mean, New York State has a good surprise billing law, but they're not going to say on the top of their bill, you know, their $100,000 bill, hey, patient, just so you know, New York State has a surprise billing law, and if some of this surprises you, you don't have to pay it. You know, so you have to be smart, and you have to know these things. And this is why I hope patients coalesce into a movement that we join together to help ourselves and also to put pressure on all of our elected officials. And we tend to get very frustrated with Washington and say, it's sclerotic, nothing happens there, which of course is true, and even more true perhaps now than ever before. But I think people have to understand there are a lot of local, in addition to individual things you can do to make it work better for yourself. I mean, one other thing I always feel like I have to say is on those financial consent forms that you sign, agreeing to pay for anything and everything when you go into the hospital, I now write in so long as it's in my network. Because I don't want to go, if I go to an in-network hospital, I don't see why it's my job to make sure that the anesthesiologist and the pathologist is in-network. That, I think we should all be kicking that back, that responsibility back to the hospitals. And in addition, we should be kicking that responsibility back to our regulators and legislators who have control over these things. This does not take an act of Congress. You know, this takes an activist insurance regulator that, you know, California is lucky to have. Most states don't. In most states, the insurance commissioner is from the insurance industry. I would like, and many of them are elected, they're a down ballot issue. I would like voters to take this up and say, you know, we want someone who's representing patients and patient interests in that job. I think the outcome would be very different. You know, likewise, I urge everyone to look at their local hospital's 990 tax form. All of these hospitals, or three quarters of them, are not-for-profit hospitals that pay few taxes because they're supposedly doing charity care and community service. Everyone, constituents, should be looking at that and seeing if they feel like the amount of service merits the tax break. A few towns have tried to take hospitals to court to take away their nonprofit status, and some have succeeded. I think, again, this is a public issue that our representatives are getting a fair amount of lobbying from their hospitals. They should be getting it from the physicians and the patients at those hospitals. The physicians are mostly not happy with this either. I mean, physicians are trying to do the right thing in a system which makes it often very hard to do the right thing. You know, my doctor would prefer to send my blood test to the cheapest lab, but his hospital provider, you know, medical record system defaults to the hospital. So anyway, I'm hoping that I will see in my near future a few things. A patient bill of rights that includes the right to know how much your care will cost. In Australia, people get binding estimates when they go into the hospital. Hospitals know about how much it will cost. Medicare pays a set fee for different kinds of diagnoses. It's not going to be easy the first time around, but if that's what we're asking for, it will come. I mean, California is unique and, again, wonderful in that it requires all hospitals to file their charge masters. I would like them to be filed in English. They're not, and they're, you know, so people could actually use them to figure out what things cost. Because you know what? If Sloan Kettering had to write down anywhere, we're charging $11,000 for our colonoscopies, A, they wouldn't charge $11,000, and B, I would go down the block where I can get a perfectly good one for $2,000, even if somebody else was paying for it. So another get that I know that you've been working on in California, which should be easy, is accurate insurance directories. When I go to book a flight online, I know how much it's going to cost to the day, to the hour. There's no reason with computers that those can't be up to date. And if we're asking people to be good consumers, well, you know, it's the mantra now, you've got to be a better consumer of healthcare. We need to have, as consumers / patients, the tools to do that. So we need prices, we need accurate information and provider directories. It can't say in-network but not taking patients. That means, to me, not in-network, right? I think we have to use our voices and use the political levers that we can to start turning the ship in a better direction. I'm not expecting the U.S. to go from 20% of our GDP to 10% overnight, but I think we have to start reeling in these healthcare costs, because I hear from way too many families who are really suffering from the amount they pay for healthcare. I hear from people who are not getting their insulin because they can't afford it. I think one of the most damning statistics I've heard from a study in the last few weeks is that patients with cystic fibrosis, which, as many of you know, is a serious chronic disease that involves secretory problems, so that most people die prematurely, generally of lung problems. People with CF live longer in Canada, by far longer in Canada than they do in the U.S. That's really pretty damning, because it tells you that some people in the U.S. are getting great care and a lot of people are getting very mediocre care or not no care at all, and that has to do with the finances. Finally, I'll give you a little story of inspiration from one patient who tried to fight back. And again, it is not going to be easy, but the more people who take action and feel empowered to do so with their physician's help, I think it's a natural alliance. We're kind of on the same side. There's one patient whose story you can read named Kathleen Williams. She's from Cincinnati, and she was in a minor bike crash. She, you know, was on this bike trail outside of Cincinnati, and someone said, oh, should we call an ambulance? And she thought she might have broken her arm, which it turned out she did. And not thinking very much, she said, sure, I guess so, because her other option was to, like, call her husband on a cell phone. And so the ambulance arrived. It was from the county fire department. She got in the ambulance, got taken to the hospital, where she indeed had an arm fracture. The hospital was covered by her insurance because it was in network, but the ambulance was out of network and charged her $1,200. And she said, wait, this is not right. You know, this is the county fire department that's taking me there. And of course, many of you may have discovered is fire departments put out fires for free, but they make money doing ambulance transports, and they bill. And P.S., more and more, because, again, the fire department is is good guys, but they've mostly outsourced the billing to business people now who say, you can make more money if you're out of network, right? So they then go out of the insurance network, and Kathleen was pretty incensed because she has Humana, which is the major insurer in Cincinnati. So she's like, wait, the fire department, my fire department that my taxes support doesn't support the ambulance. My insurance, which is the bigger insurer in Cincinnati, doesn't support my ambulance ride. So she tried to bargain, and she went to the ambulance company and said, okay, I'll pay you $500. And they said, no. Now, I think everyone should try and bargain because I've heard so many stories, and this is, again, a terrible position to put patients in, but I have heard many stories of people who went to a hospital, had a cardiac catheterization, and I hear, you know, I hear from all the rebellious patients, but what I learned from them is that being rebellious works. Had a cardiac cath, was billed $20,000, went into the business office after he was discharged and said, I'll give you $6,000. And they said, okay, we'll take it. And it's terrible to put people in this position, but I hear this over and over again. You know, another woman in the book had an air ambulance transport, billed $45,000, said, I only have $15,000, I'll take it. You know, so it and this huge divide between the notional bill charges, the list prices, and what people actually pay and what insurers actually pay is one of the primary ills of our system. But until that's dealt with, until we have a list price as they do in France, where you go to a doctor's office and there are prices on the wall, you know, we have to deal with this system, and hospitals don't expect to get those $11,000 for their colonoscopy. Now, if you ask a hospital, well, then why did they list it? They'll say, well, because sometimes someone comes in with a suitcase full of cash and we do get it. Or they'll say it creates a bargaining position for us because then it looks like we're getting, you know, we're being reasonable. But anyway, so back to Kathleen Williams. So they wouldn't take her $500. And as many of you probably have experienced, the default is either you have to pay it or we're going to send you to collections, or we'll let you set up a payment plan. So Kathleen brilliantly said, fine, I want to set up a payment plan. She is now paying the ambulance company $10 a month for the rest of her life. And she said, it was the only thing I could do to get back at them. But anyway, it's funny, but also sad. So thank you for having me here, and I look forward to questions and discussion.
Thanks. Our thanks to Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of the new book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And I just finished reading it last night, to be honest with you, and it's terrific. I recommend it both in terms of the two sections are, of course, the diagnosis of what's going on and how we got here, and, of course, also very, very practical, tactical advice and information and some tools and even some sample letters, as you say, that you can just put your name on and send them into the hospitals. And it sounds like that's worth the price of admission
right
there.
Well, it's like Mad Libs. You know, you put in your condition and the, you know, I was charged X for Y. And
that's what it seems like. Well, I'll be asking a few questions. Yeah. Some of you already written some on cards and passed them up. We've got a volunteer helping to collect them. So please continue there. I learned a lot from your book. It was very, very interesting. My grandfather was one of those old-fashioned doctors in the Bronx who was a pediatrician. Uh-huh. And when he had patients who couldn't pay, he just wouldn't bill them. He'd say, don't pay.
Yeah.
And it seemed like that was something like that was true formally or informally for a long time, the way that doctors thought about this.
Yeah.
But in your book, you detail how specialty societies have sort of changed their tune on that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I didn't mention this in the book, but as I was writing, a classmate of mine from medical school, a guy named Michael Canning, who's a general surgeon in Miami, said, oh, I was cleaning up my desk and I just found this really funny thing. And what he sent me was a piece of paper on parchment, which was the pledge he took when he was admitted into the American College of Surgeons in 1990. The pledge, it was this elaborate thing, and it said, among its clauses was, I will never charge patients beyond their ability to pay. Mm-hmm. And a few other things of that ilk. And I thought, wow, is that really still the pledge? So, of course, I immediately Google American College of Surgeons and look at today's pledge, and likewise with the AMA. and see that those clauses are all gone now.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And so I think part of it is just the ethics of, well, you know, what are the values of business? It's productivity, it's efficiency, it's revenue generation. And many of those values are kind of anathema, or at least not, you know, there may be, you know, I think of it as kind of those two circles. And sometimes the values of medicine and the values of business intersect, but often they don't. And my dad was a, you know, I remember as a kid, he was a pediatric oncologist, and we would go into his office and write the bills, which were in English, and over the weekend, and my mom would stuff them. And you know, we got a lot of good, like, chocolates and booze over around Christmas for all from all the patients who he hadn't charged. And that kind of relationship, I think, is gone. And you can say the original sin that is insurance. Now, that doesn't mean insurance is bad. It's good. But I think what happened is once treatment got more expensive, generally because medicine was advancing, you had this influx of insurance, which originally was this kind of not-for-profit thing. And once insurance was there in the middle of the last century and more people got it with Medicare and through their employers, there was this separation of nobody's really paying this, right? And so, because insurance until very recently, I mean, those of us who've been lucky enough to have it continuously know, until maybe 10 years ago, it just covered stuff, right? There wasn't this co-payment. The premiums were, you usually didn't even have to pay them. Your company paid them, right? So it was all kind of invisible. And if you're thinking as a profitable business or a for-profit business, which moved into the world of medicine in the 80s and 90s, you think, well, hey, why are you just charging $100 for that? No one would notice if you charged $200. And then the consultants come in, and you literally see this at hospitals around the year 2000, where Deloitte and McKinsey come in and say to hospitals, who are kind of in trouble because of the HMO era and cost control efforts then, and say, let's see how you're billing. And they go, you know what, you could bill a lot more for that same stuff just by manipulating how you bill. And that really sets off this crazy kind of spiral of inflation of list prices to a point where there's this big chasm between, you know, everything is notional. When people say, how do you set prices? The answer is you set them to what you think the market will bear. And I think that's what we see in our system now.
Well, you gave some examples of just crazy pricing in healthcare. But I thought when I read the book, just the most insane ones were some of the hospital examples you gave. Enormous bills, hundreds of thousands of dollars, $45,000 for miscellaneous and so forth.
Yeah.
And what many people don't know, if we poll the audience, what's the biggest cost in healthcare in the U.S.? It's hospitals by far overall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's also probably just about the least amount of price transparency in hospitals of anything else, too. So it's a bad combination of items. Now, you rightly point out that most experts agree that we've had a lot of consolidation of hospitals, hospitals buying one another, and also hospitals buying physician practices.
Right.
And that's been a big contributor to growing hospital and healthcare costs overall.
Right.
So that seems problematic. However, at the same time, with the complexity of medicine and electronic records, the solo practitioner, the solo doctor office doesn't seem to make sense either. So what's the right balance, and what are the incentives to get us at that right balance?
Well, you know, the initial narrative of consolidation was just this, you know, efficiency, you know, not every place has to do cardiac surgery, not every place has to order their own laundry, records are complex. And if consolidation is done for the purpose of better care, as it has been in some places like Kaiser Permanente, right? Mm-hmm. Then that will happen. But if consolidation is done to achieve market power and near monopoly, then high prices will be the result. And I think the latter has been far more common in our system than the former. I mean, you just look at what's happened with electronic medical records, right? The nation, all of us as taxpayers, spent literally, I think, $30 billion to encourage the uptake of medical records as part of the Recovery Act in 2008. Despite that, which should connect everyone better, like if I go to New York Presbyterian Hospital, but my normal doctor is at NYU, they can't get the records. So what did we do with this electronic medical records? Again, what's happened is that when business drives the use of any technology or any kind of medicine, what they say is, well, we don't want to share records. You know, that's letting customers go. So like Apple and PCs, you know, you want everyone in your world, and you want to do everything you can to keep them there. So why doesn't my iPhone work with a PC charger? You know, because I'm supposed to be in one world or the other. And I think a lot of hospital systems have adopted that practice, not because the doctors want it. The doctors, my talk in Washington last week, there was an ER doctor who was railing about how impossible this has made his life because, you know, he gets patients from all sorts of hospitals and he can't get the records. And that shouldn't happen anymore, right?
Well, of course, we also have doctors now owning hospital practices, right, and so forth. And do you see any conflict of interest for doctors with the various ownership structures?
Sure. Sure. And, you know, there will be endless, like, well, this just makes sense. You know, yeah. It makes sense for an orthopedist to have a physical therapy practice, and it makes sense for, a neurologist to be invested in an MRI machine. And it makes sense for dermatologists to have the stuff to do Mohs surgery, and an ophthalmologist needs one of those laser scalpels. And the problem is all of those things make sense occasionally, but once you have your office set up to do laser surgery, you're going to do it. And, you know, is the finance the motivator? For some people, it probably is. I mean, because when you buy your super-duper laser scalpel, your femtosecond laser, it actually comes with a booklet telling you, like, how many surgeries you have to do to make back the money you've spent. So, you know, it is sold as a business proposition by these companies to way more offices than probably need this tool, which may be useful, very useful for certain people, but not for everyone. But once it's there, you're going to use it. And hey, you know, you're making an extra few thousand bucks for patients, and Medicare isn't paying you enough. You know, there's a lot of self-rationalization that goes on for these things, all of which in a constrained world are mostly, when you hear them, there is a logic, but everyone is kind of explaining why it's not me. I'm just trying to do my best. It's him, and that's the problem. You know, everyone says, "Well, don't look at me." You know, dermatologists are only 0.4% of spending, and drugs are only 11%. But you know, you put it all together, and we're in this total mess. So I think that's one thing that has to stop. The kind of, "Don't look at me." You know, it's him. He's worse.
That's right.
And you know, that's not a really good justification because being worse is a really high bar in our system. Yeah. So,
this would be a good time for me to remind our listening audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, when we're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and former New York Times correspondent, about the challenges in fixing the American healthcare system. I am Mark Zitter of the Zetima Project, your moderator. You can listen to the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our YouTube channel, check out our website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. It's a question from the audience. By the way, thank you for all these wonderful questions. I promise we will not get to all of them. There's too many of them, but they're wonderful. And some are very personal about what people can do.
Right.
Can patients, or how can patients, get an explanation for the billing codes? And a somewhat related question, interesting, if you're successful in challenging a charge, would this mean the charge is passed on to the next unsuspecting patient?
Yes. I mean, not directly. I think, you know, a lot of the logic of medical billing now, and again, this is often not the hospital itself that's doing, everything has been outsourced. So, right, you see your bills come in for You go to a hospital in San Francisco and the bill comes from somewhere in Utah or somewhere in Boston, and it has someone else's, you don't even recognize any of the names on it. So, you know, these are bill collectors. Mm-hmm. They're not like thinking, oh, this is healthcare, I have to be sensitive to this patient's needs. They're thinking, this is a bill and it has to be paid. And that's their logic and that's what they're paid to do. But unfortunately, what that means is a hospital might say, yeah, you know, this person is uninsured. This is causing a lot of stress. We'll work with this person. A bill collector will say, you owe this and you don't pay and we're going to send it to collections. So I think people have to be really careful with this stuff. But, you know, so it's not that direct. If you succeed, it's not like it will be passed to the next guy because the profit margin right now is so high. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, you win some, you lose some. You know, does anyone ever expect to get those $200,000 bills paid by insurers? No, but there's no harm in trying. And that's, I think, the logic of hospital billing now. Mm-hmm. So I think... what was the first part of the question? Sorry.
It was about how can people get the billing codes?
This is where the internet is a wonderful thing. you can Google billing codes and you'll find out a lot. You know, you may not get all the answers you want, but it's your right to ask the billing department, well, what does 101.73 stand for? And be stubborn. You know, you wouldn't go to a supermarket and you know, buy a bunch of things and go home and a month later get a bill that was in, you know, in another language. So, you know, be stubborn. Insist on knowing before you pay. Also, I think there are some really useful pricing tools out there. There's something called Clear Health Costs, which I know is quite active here, fairhealth.com, Prater US, there are a whole bunch of them. And those, and Goodrx for prescriptions, you know, it's not like... those will give you an average of what people are paying in your zip code. Mm-hmm. And that's helpful for your negotiating purposes, right? Or you can find out what Medicare would pay, what its DRG payment. And if you're going into a hospital, you can say, look, I see that you're charging me three times what Medicare would pay and twice what the other providers would pay. It gives you kind of a leg to stand on in your negotiating, which, again, terrible position to put patients in. My first position is like, I don't have to, you know, I don't need a consultant or I don't have to go online to see how much blueberries cost at West Side Market, but this is where we are. And so, you know, and I think the more we ask these kind of questions, the more we'll get to a place where we are told prices because we're asking a lot and the prices will be real prices. You know, I'm still waiting and we see some surgery centers that are starting this. But I'm still waiting for one of the hospitals in New York, which is a much less consolidated market than here. There are four or five really good healthcare systems. Once one of them puts up a billboard that says, no surprise charges, guaranteed prices, people will go, you know, and the others will have to start showing their hand too. So, you know, is that going to happen tomorrow? No, but I think we should all start asking.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, a big thesis of your book is that the profit, money-seeking motive in healthcare has driven the costs and driven the interest in profit above interest in patients. So I think even a cynic, maybe especially a cynic, would assume that eventually some companies would emerge that would try to help patients combat those companies that are seeking profits at their expense. And they have. There are some firms such as Compass or Castlight, right, that give patients price information to help them make better choices. Yet in the book, you didn't seem very high on those. Why not?
Well, I think they're helpful if you you can go to a bill troubleshooter if you have a huge bill, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a $200,000 bill or a $100,000 bill, it'll be worth it. But we all have higher deductible plans, you know, maybe $5,000. You know, so you get a bill for $3,000. It's not worth paying someone to negotiate that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is those are all in and of themselves for-profit businesses. And I don't have problems with for-profit businesses per se, but really what you see in our system over and over again is if there's a problem, so if a hospital thinks a joint maker is charging too much for artificial, for joint implants. Then you see each side will get a joint broker, and then there'll be a joint negotiator in the middle. So then you have like this chain of people, all of whom is taking 10% out. And, you know, in the name of saving costs, you're adding, and overall the cost may be a little bit less, but it's still, I mean, I think Compass and Castlight, they do some good things, but my likewise, Clear Health costs, all of these things. My backstop position is, why do I have to hire a consultant to tell me what something costs? Mm-hmm. And P.S., you know, the thing you hear about something like Compass is Compass doesn't, because that's their, you know, these companies, what they have are these databases that tell them what a reasonable price is. So they're not going to share their database. They're not going to share the actual pricing. They'll say, oh, you can get a cheaper one here. Mm-hmm. Well, why can't I just have, why aren't all the prices just posted? You know, because then, as someone said in the book, because then I don't need Compass anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Why would I pay? So I think these things are useful interim solutions. I feel a little uncomfortable that we have to pay for each of them. And the optimum for me is that you don't need these kind of services. And I do worry slightly that the growth of all these services will prevent us from getting to the place which I see as better, which is I don't need a consultant when I walk into a hospital. I don't need a patient advocate. You know, the Affordable Care Act I thought was a really important thing, but one of the sad things to me was that they needed $70 million worth of navigators. You know, that tells me that this is a really complicated system. And to me, that's sad. You know, why should you need navigators to buy health insurance? I think, again, it's a really hard, it's a terrible position to put people in, and really terrible to put them in it each year and to say, shop around again. It's exhausting, you know, it's really exhausting.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't plant this question, but I yeah, like it. It,
sure.
It says Dr. Bob Kosher, who's a physician and was in the Obama White House, mentioned in a recent Zedema discussion that while it may be possible to bargain for low-cost items such as lab work, it's much more difficult for patients to do so, either for larger ticket items or, as I guess you said in your book, for instance, asking a clinician, every clinician who shows up at your hospital bed, you know, who are you and are you in network and so forth.
Yeah.
Even though I applaud your efforts to get, but it seems kind of quixotic to expect patients to really be that activist, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know. Does it? You know, you're paying a lot for this. So I, you know, yes, it's hard, but it's not that hard. And you know, if you have someone with you in the hospital, I don't know. We feel like we're kind of sitting ducks, right? So a dermatologist comes in and looks at your rash that you know has been there for a year. Why can't you say, who are you? Who sent you? Thank you, but my doctor has looked at this and I don't need you. You know, I think we should, for some of those big bills, I mean, the woman in the book who was charged $350,000 for a brain aneurysm, she looked at her bill and discovered, she came into the hospital comatose, she looked at her bill and discovered she was being charged $80,000 for outpatient surgery. You know, 50% to 90% of hospital bills and studies have errors. You're going to see them. I mean, one of my favorite was someone here in San Francisco who he and his wife had a baby, and there was a bill for a circumcision. The baby had not been circumcised. He knew that. His insurer didn't. So I think, yes, it's true that hospital bills are harder, but they're also big, and you know what happened in the hospital. I mean, I get a lot of complaints from physicians when they become patients who say, you know, wow, I didn't know I was being billed this way. You know, one woman said to me, you know, my husband was walked to the bathroom after an artificial hip, and they billed that as physical therapy. That wasn't physical therapy, you know. And she objected to that bill because for her, it gave her profession a bad name, and she didn't like that. Mm-hmm. So I think we can. You know, part of the problem with these big hospital bills in terms of our incentives is we pay the first, you know, We have a high deductible, right? Mm-hmm. Or we have a deductible. So we pay the first $5,000 to $10,000 maybe or less. But then after that, you're like, woohoo, you know, someone else is paying, right?
Yeah.
So the problem with this skin in the game narrative is for the really big bills, we have very little incentive to care because it's not coming out of our pocket
right. If
we have insurance. So not that I think we should have more skin in the game. I think we have plenty. But I think that whole system of saying, you know, skin in the game, it really works for little things maybe, although now we're expecting people to pay so much that it isn't. It's more than just skin. It's like I say in the book, I think it's like having a kidney in the game. You know,
it's
too much. But for those big hospital bills, that's part of the reason hospitals – more than physician practices get away with these really, really high charges because people are relatively price insensitive to what goes on in hospitals. So, again, big burden. You're sick. You don't want to deal with this, but it's the hand we've been dealt. And
have to work on with it. So you had mentioned that Australia has an informed financial consent law.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that New York State has a no surprises law, although
right.
it sounds like for most people in New York, it's a surprise that law exists. They don't even know
right,
about that.
Right, right.
Does the question here is, does California have anything like that?
Not that I know of yet. And the New York State one is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the New York State one I take a little issue with because, again, it is not, it's a surprise billing law, mm-hmm. so you have to know it exists. And then the patient, it's the onus is on the patient to take the surprise bill, fill out this form in triplicate, send it to your insurer, send it to your provider, and or you even have to fax it. Or so. It's like this insane system that, you know, and so and it basically, you know, absolves you of paying for it, which is good. But again, I don't quite get why the onus should be on the patient in this situation.
Yeah, it's difficult for the patient to make those things happen.
I mean, how much time do we all spend navigating medical bills? It's really crazy. I mean, that is to me why, and doctors do it 24/7. It's why I think I hear more and more physicians saying, you know, fine, just do like Medicare or single payer so I don't have to deal with this anymore. You know, it's become a nightmare for everyone. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry. I'm not advocating one thing or another, but I think, you know, it's that, you know, when we say it takes up, healthcare costs are nearly 20% of our GDP. That doesn't include all the, what do economists call it? The cost of all the time that people waste.
Oh, yeah.
Doing this.
Yeah.
Opportunity costs. Thank you.
So there's, your book really documents very well some of the problems that are caused by having a profit-focused healthcare system. Are there benefits? You know, it seems to me that to some degree, you think of some innovations, for instance, the rare disease drugs and so forth. You can say they're overpriced, but you could probably also say if we didn't have that profit incentive, we wouldn't have invented them, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that is an argument. I think there are two problems with it. You know, not everything that's important is profitable, and that becomes a big problem. We get treatments. We have a lot of innovation in areas that are very profitable. So if you think you can sell a drug for $200,000, there's tons of innovation. And because of that, we've seen a burst of new drugs for rare diseases. If something's not profitable, good luck finding anyone to finance the innovation. You know, and the example I like to give, which I know makes everyone really uncomfortable and is somewhat flawed, but you know, someone said to me, if we had this current profit-oriented research financing when Salk was developing the polio vaccine, we wouldn't have a polio vaccine. Instead, we'd have iron lungs in 10 different colors with iPhone apps. And, you know, it's so yes, it does get us a certain kind of innovation and often gets it to us first. You know, we see, but again, you know, driving over the Bay Bridge, I see billboards for Keytruda and Opdivo, you know, very high-priced cancer drugs for a small number of patients or approved for a small number of patients with stage 4 lung cancer who, and the studies show they, on average, extend life by a few, I mean, you would know this, a few months. But it's, you know, there it is advertised on the Bay Bridge. That drug, I had a friend who had stage 4 lung cancer in England, and the NHS would not give that drug. He had to pay out of pocket, I think, $20,000 a month for it. Wow. In this country, he probably would have gotten it. You know, whether it's a good idea for him to have gotten it, I think, is another question, because... and it's certainly whether it's a good idea for it to be advertised and advertised on TV with this, what is to me a kind of false narrative of, you know, the advertisement says, you know, don't you want a longer life? Not like, you know, and then in small print, you know, blah, 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 all the side effects and, you know, that it may extend your life by 3 months. You know, so I think, you know, it leads to a certain kind of innovation. Now, the pharma will say, and I have no idea if this is really true or not true, that, you know, Germany and France don't pay us enough to support innovation, so we've got to charge you guys a lot. And my answer to that is, like, fine, charge them more. But, you know, why are we the schmucks who are who are paying for global innovation? Yeah. And I think, you know, we're the only country that doesn't in some way bargain for pharmaceutical prices. And I think we end up paying disproportionately for that. I mean, and there are certain drugs, and this is kind of to me very symptomatic of the problem, that are only sold in the U.S. because there's essentially no market for them in any other country, where people would say, this is not actually a useful drug, you know, or it's certainly not worth... $8,000 a month, you know, there's a chapter in the book about one that I was particularly obsessed with. Something you may have seen advertising for, a drug about a condition called Non-24. It's a sleep-wake disorder in people who are totally blind. You know, it affects, and it's a serious thing for people who are affected by it. You know, maybe at most 70,000 people. But it's advertised on late night TV, and it's, and I'm like, well, what's the game here? And
but it's for blind people. It's advertised on TV.
Yeah,
Is there an irony there?
And you know, people may be listening to TV. That's all right. You know, it's but it's you look at the FDA hearings for the approval of this drug, and the people on the panel are incredibly uncomfortable because the drug that it's advertising is something called Hetlioz, which is a, it's a slightly modified melatonin. That's all, right? Mm-hmm. And the reviewers are kind of saying, well, you know, why don't you just give people melatonin? But of course, the FDA standard, and they're just doing their job according to their, you know, the FDA rules, is it safe and effective? So it doesn't have to be tested against melatonin or against, you know, any of the 20 other sleep pills. So it is safe. Of course, it's melatonin, and it's effective, you know, more effective than nothing. Because it's an orphan drug, it's tested on very few people. The more effective, it increased the length of sleep from like 3.5 hours to 4 hours and 5 minutes. So one of the reviewers says, gee, you know, that's pretty dreadful. You know, that's not really much of an improvement. And, you know, they say, look, that's not the issue. It's, is it better? And is it better than nothing? And yes, it's better than nothing. And there you go. You know, the reviewers, one of whom is in the book, were very uncomfortable with approving it. But according to the standards that we use, it was approvable. And guess what? They had no idea how much this was going to be priced. And it is priced at something, it's at least $1,000 a month. And now there's an advertising campaign, right? Mm-hmm. So, now what's the market here? I mean, I think that's the interesting issue. And now the same company that got it approved, because now it can be used off-label, of course, right, is doing testing for jet lag. And that's probably the market they're after.
Overall.
And, you know, so now people are going to say, and you look at the test, you know, I'm picking on this drug, but a lot of drugs do this. You look at the, could you have non-24, and it's like, do you get tired sometimes in the daytime? You know, are you, you know, it's like everyone could have this. And you know, studies show that if patients ask their doctor, more than half of doctors, if they think it won't harm the patient, will write the script. And the doctor, P.S., and I'm sure the physicians in the room know this, you know, when the detail person comes by your office or your hospital and says, we've got this great new drug for sleeping, you know, it's natural, it's just like melatonin, they don't say, oh, and we're charging $1,000 a month for it. So the person writing the script probably doesn't have any idea how much it's going to cost.
Well, and in America, we want more stuff, but don't connect the cost to it.
Yeah, and so, yeah, we do, you know, it does produce some really game-changing innovation. I think more and more it produces innovation that's profitable but probably doesn't add much because it just kind of plays. If you're in business, you know, these are for-profit companies and they're looking for opportunities created by the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, often when I call people and say, like, why are you billing this or how are you charging? And the first answer I get is, well, it's legal. And I'm like, right, I know it's legal. But, you know, we have set the rules this way. So we have to say to the FDA, for example, you know, change that metric of safe and effective. You know, there are dozens of MS drugs out there that are really important and really helpful for patients, but they haven't been tested against each other. So, you know, because it's in no one's interest to do those tests if we rely on the market. Everyone is perfectly happy to be having their $6,000 a month share of the market per patient.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you the question that we've gotten most often here, you knew you'd get, and that is about, will single-payer healthcare solve this? Would it solve it? And what's the likelihood it will ever happen?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, I think this is... this is really a case where, and what I try and learn from other countries in the book is that there are lots of ways that other countries have kept costs to a fraction of what ours are. And each country picks its solution according to its values, its politics, its medical practices, which are, you know, I'm always a little amused, though, in the U.S. everyone says, oh, you know, we like choice. Americans really want choice. And then when you say, well, to my neighbor, you know, well, how did you choose that surgeon? They'll go, oh, well, you know, my sister plays golf with him. You know, it's so I think choice, and this is why, you know, the Kaiser Permanente has consistently good marks on results because, you know, basically you're buying into a system you trust and allowing them to make many of those choices. But so, you know, some countries have gone to single payer. I should point out in our country we think of single payer, particularly those who want to badmouth it, that you know, it's this kind of monolithic thing where, you know, prices are shoved down doctors' throats. I mean, single payer means different things in different countries. In Japan, for example, there's a single payer system, but most of the doctors and hospitals are private. In Britain and Canada, there's a more nationalized health system where the government owns the hospitals, and many of the doctors, though not the primary care doctors in England, are paid by the government. You know, at another more market-based system, like in Switzerland or even Germany, there are a lot of insurers. Everyone has to have insurance. I would note that in Germany, the insurers are all not-for-profit, which is a big difference from our country. But in all of those countries, there's some much more direct mechanism to control prices. And again, it doesn't have to be this monolithic, you know, we're going to tell you what we're going to pay. In many countries, those prices are essentially set in the kind of thing we do for every little medical procedure. You know, the physicians groups, the insurers, and the government will get together and decide what's a reasonable amount to pay for this hip implant, what's a reasonable amount to charge for a colonoscopy. And there are these kind of massive negotiations. So would a single payer help? It will do a lot of things. I mean, Medicare is a single payer system. It has its flaws, but I think, you know, I hear from a lot of people in their late 50s and early 60s who talk about the promised land of Medicare, you know, where for its flaws, it the prices are relatively predictable. And so it would help, but I think it's a choice we could make. You know, people say, well, that's really radical. At the very end of the campaign last year, Hillary Clinton proposed lowering the Medicare age, right? You could get to a Medicare-based single-payer system by slowly, progressively lowering the Medicare age. And, you know, we would wake up one morning and go, oh, how did this happen? We have, you know. but you don't have to go in that direction, and single-payer is really focused more on the insurers than on, you know, there's no one bad guy in this system, so I think there are lots of ways to skin this cat. But I think any of them to be successful involve really directly facing this problem of price and cost and regulating it or controlling it in some way.
Great. So. Thanks. We're going to have to leave it at that. It's our thanks to Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of the new book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. We want to remind everyone here that Dr. Rosenthal's book is for sale, and she'll be signing copies right after the program down the hall in the fireside room. I'm Mark Zitter of the Zedema Project, and for now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
I like that.